Hi, everyone. Those of you still listening or just tuning in, we are starting our last interview of the day with the magnificent Andrew Fairweather of Andrew Fairweather, but who we met through the New York Public Library. And I will let Andrew introduce himself with a little bit more breadth, but we, in a large part, couldn't have done a lot of our radio programming and achieve our kind of reach, our goal of reaching kids around the neighborhood without Andrew. And part of the reason that we wanted to talk to you is because we, or at least I would love to know why you're working for an institution that seems so, well, we spoke about this before, it's the only institution that exists that trusts people with things, gives them things and brings them back. And so, yeah, just generally I'm very interested to know all about how you got into that line of work. But Andrew, oh, and also Carrie's here with us.
Hi.
So used to babbling on today.
It's been the Bella show today.
Yeah, Dong is galling. So you still have time to buy your gala tickets, by the way. Just throwing that in there. But it's all Andrew now for the next hour. Yeah. So Andrew, do you want to?
Sure. My name is Andrew Fairweather. I've been working at the Seward Park branch of the New York Public Library on the Lower East Side at 192 East Broadway for 6 years now, just about. And it's an interesting question how I got involved in libraries. It wasn't really an intentional choice. I don't make much of those.
intentional choices?
No, I don't. I'm at the mercy of things, and I sort of embrace whatever's going on. I never thought I would work at a library, and I think because I'm from Los Angeles, which is a system that doesn't particularly feel like it's hiring a lot of the time, I had a friend, Brian, whose mother and brother both worked for the library system, and it just seemed so much like a secret guild that was very hard to break into. So it never really occurred to me I could work at a library. Certainly when I was in Los Angeles, it never felt possible. But when I went to New York, I was coming from Los Angeles to New York. I'm born and raised in Los Angeles. And my intention was to continue some sort of thing in arts administration, because I had been in food service for the longest time, and I had managed to escape the trap that is food service through doing some work with this chamber music organization in Los Angeles for a couple of years. And I'd be damned if I was going to fall back into the, you know,
Chamber music.
Starbucks coffee.
No, coffee. Oh.
Well, that was interesting.
I thought you were going to go into the next thing and say, I'll be damned before I fall back into the restaurant world. I'll be damned before I fall back into
yes. Well, the chamber music was pretty pleasant stuff. I mean, the way I got that's a whole story in and of itself. Yeah, I don't know. You do things for a certain amount of time, and you just sort of feel like you're doing it forever. I think my first job when I was 16 was Starbucks coffee, and I had that for 5 years.
Wow.
So you just figure you're doing that for the rest of your life. But my intention was to get involved in arts administration, and I had applied to dozens and dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of jobs, as you do. And I had two interviews, and one was with Bonham's Auctioneering, and the other was with the New York Public Library, which was wild to me because I didn't know libraries actually hired you. So I had an interview with the New York Public Library, I had an interview with Bonham's, and just my luck, I get offered both jobs, and which, I mean, Jesus Christ, it's unheard of. Exact same salary, exact same benefits. The library was union. Bonham's wasn't. And I accepted the library job over the Bonham's job. I think I think in the chamber music organization, which was very fulfilling work. I mean, I enjoyed it, but you deal with a certain class of people, and I think I had a certain fill of it.
That makes a lot of sense.
I was ready to return back to the, you know.
There's a few people in the chamber music world that get their coffee at Starbucks.
That's true.
I can imagine that.
That's true.
That you might want to just
separated by a partition, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got the job. The title was an assistant, an information assistant, they call it, at the library. And I did that for about 5 years, and I went back to school part-time about 3 years into it, and I went back to Queen's College to do my library science degree, and 2 years later, no breaks, I got it. And
great.
A colleague retired, and I slipped on into the adult department and became an adult librarian, and that's why I'm still here.
That's why you're still here.
I hope to be here for a while. So that's the journey.
What did you, because you said you went back to college, what did you study initially?
Oh, believe it or not, I did a bachelor's in fine arts at CalArts.
Oh, yeah. That's CalArts.
Isn't that something?
That's amazing.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience, too. I still don't know why I got into that school. I had terrible grades in high school, and I didn't particularly relish going to college. And I think I more or less made up my mind that if I was going to college, it would be art school, because it was the only thing that I had any sort of, I don't know, I wouldn't even call it enthusiasm for. It was the only thing. I wasn't a very intelligent teenager, I'll just put it that way. But these art schools were paying attention to me, and it was very flattering. And so I applied to the schools in the area, which were Otis Arts Center and CalArts, and I did get into all three, but Arts Center and CalArts.
So this is a trend with you.
It's a trend.
I feel
with
like
me, yes.
We have an Andrew underestimating himself.
I must say, life has been kind to me since I was 18 years old. And I don't know why, and I have this nagging feeling I haven't deserved any of it.
No.
I know it sounds ominous, but it's, I can't shake it.
Well, I hope you find that, because as much as I can say now that you do, probably not going to believe me.
Yeah, but like, life isn't like a zero sum. It's not like there's like a set level amount of deserving, and like you have to spread it across the world. It's like it's not zero sum. So you know,
absolutely,
you deserve it in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
Well, I was telling, I think I was telling you, Bella, or I was telling Cass. I was. I had a very rocky adolescence. I think, you know,
spoke about it.
Yeah, like looking back, you do certain things. I think I was the last generation where every move you're making isn't being documented. And I'm so grateful that.
It's important.
I could do things and they're completely off the record and no one remembers them. And I can emerge from that as this person who works at a library and, you know, no one has, and I just feel like it's a shame today, because these days when you're a teenager, I mean, everything you're doing is somewhere out there. It's being posted, it's being talked about. And God, that's just, if everyone paid attention to what I was saying when I was a teenager, I mean, Jesus. Yeah. I mean, that's like...
I mean, there's universities that look at people on social media before.
It's terrifying.
It's really...
So I do count myself as grateful.
You need a warrant in order to go into somebody's house, but nobody...
Yeah.
You know, thinks in that same way when they're, you know, digging into somebody... You'd think that a university application
would
have all the information that you want to show them in front of you. And you should use
it. Completely agree. So,
I mean, it's a whole other privacy discussion. That's
it is. Yeah. It really is. That's an hour in itself. Ever since 18, I felt very, very grateful for the trajectory of my life, not just in the, you know, school and all that, but so many great people I've been able to meet. And you know, leaving Los Angeles was so difficult because I have so many good friends over there, and but you know, I never liked Los Angeles, and it's so nice to be here. Instead,
you only liked the people, you didn't like the place.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, and you know, to this day, you can always tell who's from Los Angeles, and I sort of recognize it in their eyes or whatever. And they're very pleasant people and all that. But
how often do you go back?
I go once a year to see my parents, and I think the first time I went back, I made this big deal about how I was coming back, and then everyone wants to see you, and then you don't see everyone, and people get offended. So now I'm sort of careful. I tell select few people, and I see my parents, and I have a good old 2 weeks of it.
Yeah,
every January, 2 weeks. Yeah,
that's a long home visit.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but to come from LA directly to New York and then to be working in a library, like, have you been in the same library, the Seward Park? The
same one, 6 years.
Like, that's such an amazing kind of transition into New York. Like, you're, like, confronted with New York immediately.
Yeah. No, I do know what you're saying. I think, you know, I think working at the library is interesting insofar as there's, I guess the way I would put it is there seems to be a lot of agenda around things like, you know, how do we get people together to listen to each other? How do we get people, you know, of different economic and racial backgrounds, you know, to understand each other and so on and so on. And that's not to say everyone who comes into a library willingly shares and understands each other, but it is to say that it literally happens, you know, that you come into a library and there's, you know, negotiation of space going on. And, you know, you see people who are quite good at being freelancers and making, you know, decent money, and the library is their office, for instance, and next to people who are recovering from a drug habit, and then you just need a place to go that's not where they were, you know. And I think, again, I'm not saying that it's a beautiful, harmonious story and everyone willingly does this and it's the way it ought to be. But I'm saying that this literally happens at the library every day. And I think that the library is an incredible institution for that reason. Is it almost seems to me like there's a world, there's like a media world that bickers and bickers and bickers, and then there's the library where problems do exist, but we're all getting along, and it's kind of it's an example in a way.
Well, in this country there are so few like public indoor spaces, you know, that are truly accessible to anyone who wants to walk in, and it's just this incredibly rare institution in this country. So it's like very cool that you get to experience that, and that was like your first experience of New York in a place like Chinatown or the Lower East Side that's like so unique.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's interesting to see the profession sort of return to form in a way. If you look at the architecture of the Seward Park Library, for instance, but a lot of the Carnegie Libraries from 100 years ago, more or less, more than 100 years ago at this point. We're having our 110th anniversary next year, actually.
Oh. That's old for New York.
Very old, yeah. 110 years.
Yeah.
It's still there. but you see very well fenestrated buildings, lots of light pouring in, lots of space, lots of congregation areas and so on in these old libraries, and you see it in the new libraries as well. What you don't see it in is the mid-century libraries, which are nicknamed the Lindsay boxes. This was a study of space done by the Center for an Urban Future a few years back. And what they found, it was a study particular to the library systems in New York, and what they found was that the trend for library construction these days is an emphasis on space, not on shelves. And people can go back and forth about, you know, should that be the case, but it is the case. And the space ratio, the public space ratio, is much similar in the old Carnegie libraries than it was in the mid-century Lindsay boxes, because in the 100 years ago, they made libraries not just for information. That was a thing there. Not just for education. They would have called it education, not information, which is a whole other distinction. But they made it for public space because, especially in an area like the Lower East Side, which, as I was saying earlier, reached its peak population around 1911 at 500,000 something odd people. You needed a place to go that was much more spacious and that, you know, had amenities and so on. So that's always been a part of the mission of the public libraries, bringing all these people together and sharing a space. It wasn't really until the mid-century in the 50s and 60s you started to see the library as a, quote, information center, which is a very different mission than it was in the turn of the century. And the interesting thing is, despite the radical changes in library service today, what we're doing in terms of, you know, children's programming, in terms of the emphasis on space and construction, and just all the things we tend to emphasize today have much more in common with 100 years ago than it did 50 years ago.
What was the change to bring more information into the libraries? Was there an ask for that?
Really what it was, there's some interesting books that correlate. This hasn't really been written about directly, but there's some interesting books that I sort of correlate this change with. There's Tim Wu's book called The Master Switch, which charts ebbs and flows of consolidation and... what's the word I'm looking for? Consolidation. What's the opposite of a consolidation, guys? Like fragmentation?
Networky?
Yeah, we'll say fragmentation. Okay. This is a word he used. There's cycles of consolidation and fragmentation in information systems. And the 50s and 60s, as we know, was, you know, the beginning of the cybernetic period and, like, right, centralized systems of information. And I think... the library is always a vehicle for these cultural shifts. And I think in the 50s and 60s, what we think of is, you know, centralized, consolidated information networks, you know, television shows, radio stations, everything going through one channel, you know, big newspapers and so on and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. I think the library as a destination for information sort of matches up with that cycle of information. You see more familiar to us now because it's more recent history, you see the library beginning to question what it does a bit more with, again, the fragmentation of information which occurs due to the internet in the 1990s.
Right.
So the library is always reacting to these different... cycles of technology, fragmentation, centralization. You know, with the recent ruling of net neutrality, you know, this could be one of the things I was thinking about is this a move towards centralization again? Obviously it's not like, you know, CBS, NBC sort of centralization, but like preferred choice connect access to information. Where does the library fall in that? So again, the library is...
Do you want the library to have that kind of responsibility?
I don't know if it's as interesting. And I also don't know if it's for me to say. I think you know, I think that it's a tricky spot, right? Because when the library is sort of a given, as it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s when we did have this more centralized network of information, what you're doing is almost less interesting, I guess, is you're just sort of, you're teaching people how to use and unearth pieces of information from a network. Mm-hmm. And that's an analytic task. Again, you're teaching people how to use boxes and fields and whatever. I don't find that quite as interesting as being forced to come up with programming which attempts to reevaluate. Yeah. Like, we do tons of things at Seward Park. We do a 16 millimeter film series. We do popular film series. We do karaoke. We do tea time.
You can fill a whole day with all of these things.
No, absolutely, absolutely. We're a very busy program. Yeah. Sorry, we're a very busy library in terms of programming. And I don't know whether that would be the case if our job was really to teach people how to, you know, use, you know. And again, when it comes to information itself, the job is also more interesting mm-hmm. and much more philosophical. I think that there are assumptions people make about information today that are possibly more dangerous than they were in previous times because we just have access to so much.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite writers, who just released a memoir this year, Bitwise, David Auerbach, writes that the problem today, I think the assumption today is that there are not enough facts out there and that if we just knew the facts, we would know what to do. And unfortunately, it's a little more difficult than that. And so what he says is the problem is that there are too many facts mm-hmm. and that we don't realize that facts, the meaning of facts are only revealed through an arrangement in a narrative. And if some arrangements are deliberately manipulative, they are still facts, mm-hmm. but they're deliberately manipulative, and they don't faithfully follow something we could call like reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a trickier thing than just finding out what's true and what's false. And I think the library of old, or the mid-century library, the cybernetic library, I'll say, was about finding out what was true, what was false, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. The job is trickier these days. So when I do my digital literacy presentation to high schools, I'm not telling them, you know, make sure you know your facts are true, blah, blah, blah. I think that's quite obvious. I'm telling them that when you use facts, you're crafting an argument as you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And to be aware of that is to not just know how to make an argument, but to know how to analyze other people's arguments. And I think that's the tricky thing today. And I think, you know, to the library's point, to the library's credit, it still is one of the few places where there are access to long-form arguments and not just sort of, you know, short little pieces about the way I feel about this or that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you gone past and visited a lot or most or some of the other libraries around New York City?
Yeah.
Public libraries?
Yeah, actually, when I first moved to New York, I made a point to, because I think the libraries are so beautiful in this city.
Yeah.
In L.A., there are a few beautiful ones. There's a beautiful one in MacArthur Park. The Central Library is gorgeous, and I had the privilege of working in downtown when I worked at the Chamber Music Organization, and so I went to that library every time.
Yeah.
But it is quite remarkable how different every library is based upon the neighborhood. Like, you know, I'll give tours to ESL students. We just wrapped up a number of tours from the university settlement, and like, you're constantly telling them, you know, most of our movies here are in Chinese and English, but that is not the case down the road. You know, if you go to Hamilton Fish, it's different. If you go to Tompkins Square, it's different. Ottendorfer will be different. Chatham Square, indeed, will be different. And they really are a reflection of the neighborhood. I'd say my favorite that I've been to would be Ottendorfer, which is being renovated right now because it's the oldest active public library in the city because it used to be, when the Lower East Side was Kleine Deutschland, it was a German language library. And it's got this beautiful red brick with these busts of these German luminaries and beautiful black iron shelves. It's gorgeous. And it's tiny, but I love it.
Where is it?
It's on 2nd Avenue in St. Mark's. It's kind of hard to... I think people walk by it all the time without knowing it's a library. It's a public library. It's beautiful.
Do you know which building?
No. But I was going to ask you... So I used to live in Queens, and I know that Queens and some of the other boroughs have their own public library systems. And what's the deal with that? What is
That's interesting. And it's something, honestly, like going back to those ESL tours, it's so difficult to explain this to people who are learning English. That because, again, a lot of the people going to these classes don't live in Manhattan. They live in Brooklyn and Queens. And so I'm giving them a library card, and I'm stressing very, very greatly. Do not return these books to
Brooklyn Queens. Yeah.
The New York Public Library system is Manhattan, Staten Island, and the Bronx. So if anyone's wondering, you may return and borrow in any of those libraries if you have a New York Public Library card. Manhattan, Staten Island, and the Bronx.
It covers a pretty big chunk.
It's pretty big, yeah. Brooklyn is its own system, and Queens is its own system. Yeah. So we have three systems in all of New York City. The reason for that, I think... I don't know for a fact, but I'm pretty sure the reason for that is that the library systems were established before consolidation.
Yeah.
Before there was a New York City that was five boroughs,
right.
There were these library systems that had exist. I think New York Public Library is 1895 or something like that. Could be before then. But the New York Public Library was more or less... It was not just an establishment of a system. It was a consolidation of smaller library systems within Manhattan. You had the Grace Aguilar Circulating Library, which was... Grace Aguilar was a... Gosh, she was either Spanish or Portuguese, Jewish English writer. And so they had three circulating libraries of the Grace Aguilar system, one of which was the library that would eventually be replaced by Seward Park. The library I work at. You had the New York Free Circulating Library, which used to be the building that Bloomingdale is in. Actually, if anyone is interested in the history and the architecture, go to the Aguilar Library up in East Harlem. You'll notice the architecture is slightly different from most other Carnegies. It's because it's not a Carnegie. It was built for the Grace Aguilar system. So that is an older building than most of the New York Public Library systems, just like Ottendorfer. So it looks kind of as these massive columns.
My goodness, this is amazing.
I know.
I think you should
just want to go and walk around and visit all of these libraries
with you. That would just be, you should start doing tours on the side or something.
I do tours.
Andrew's gonna laugh at me, but did Carrie, did you ever hear about Andrew's Sunday routine?
No.
Oh God, yeah.
Sorry, I keep asking you to explain this over and over again, but it'll make you want to do that on Sunday or any other day, and then go past all the libraries, and it's...
Well, there's a pastry shop on 110th Street, and I do not live in Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn, I'll have you know, so it's quite a trip.
Where in Brooklyn?
Bushwick.
Yeah, that is a trip. Yeah. What are you going to do when the L closes?
When what closes? I don't take the L, I take the J.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
But, you know, we're all worried because all the people who take the L are not going to go to the J and all that, so... every Sunday I take the train up to 110th Street to the Hungarian pastry shop, and I've been doing this for years. I get a Hamantash and a black coffee, and it's a great place because you can refill this coffee over and over and over again on your own volition. You don't have to ask. You don't even have to bother anybody. And my favorite part is it's a Sunday, so most of the libraries are closed. They don't play any music in this place, which is a godsend. I mean, why does every place you go into have to be playing music? I don't understand it. It's harassment, in my opinion. For me, the winning thing about this
place...
You
truly work in a library.
Yeah.
You're just like, shh. Yeah, shh. It's like built into you, like, as a person.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's good to know that. Good to know that.
Okay, so quiet Hungarian coffee shop.
Yeah.
Pastry shop.
And you can read for a couple hours, and then it fills up. And by the time it fills up, you've already been reading for a couple hours, and you're ready to go. And you walk all the way down Manhattan, and there's three things you can do from that point. You can take Amsterdam or Broadway all the way down through the West Side to the West Village, and you can have lunch at Waverly Restaurant. Or you can... walk through Central Park and go to the Boathouse Cafe and get a burger for $6.
Mm-hmm.
And then walk down, you know, fashionable Park Avenue and until you get to Canal Street or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can go to the East Side walk across Central Park North to East Harlem, and then walk all the way down Lexington They have this nice little hill, sort of like very old Bunker Hill LA-ish, mm-hmm. you know. Walk through the Upper East Side, through Midtown, until you get to the Lower East Side and take the train back or whatever. That's
How do you decide? You just like each Sunday, it's whatever you feel fancy. Like. You truly do not live life with any plans. You're just kind of like
No, I don't have any plans.
That's
sometimes you want plans though.
Except groceries today.
Yeah, except groceries today. Yeah. I've been.
I caught you.
I've been tossing and turning about whether I'm going to go to the gala tonight or do groceries.
Carrie was deciding the same thing. No, well,
not exactly, but I do have those. It's like, should I go to this friend's thing or should I go to the gym? And the gym always wins. So, yeah, you know.
There's something, exercise is very, I don't know, there's nothing like it. Mm. It's nice. And, you know, your friends will always be there.
Exactly.
The opportunity to exercise might pass.
Exactly.
I don't know. But it also depends on which route. Central Park is Central Park.
Yeah.
The East Side offers you the Met, which you can go to for $1 and sit in. And, you know, there's the room with the Gainsborough paintings and the Joshua Reynolds paintings of aristocrats with their hounds licking their hands as they casually drink wine. And there's the, you know, Chinese jade room with carved red lacquer. You can just sit there for a while and do more reading if you want.
Have you seen the there's a 72 foot long scroll of it's in the China wing. It's the emperor what is it called again? So David Hockney made a film walking you through and talking you through. Have I told you about this before? Walking you through this scroll. And you hear him speaking, you follow his hands along the scroll, and it's called Surface is Illusion, But So is Depth.
Mm.
Or The Journey across the Grand Canal with the Emperor of China. Mm. And I think that's the name or the what's happening in this scroll. That's something I go back to very often. And you see this... you see his fingers moving along, but what he points out is that you have constant changing perspectives in order to let this story keep unfolding and keep moving and to reveal all sorts of different parts of all these villages and all these moments where he's meeting people, where his boat is docking, where his... I feel like we should make one of those for Andrew. Up Manhattan.
Do you write?
I don't know. I wrote some. I keep a book journal through Goodreads. I realized that I was reading and then forgetting what I read a week later. So what I 3 years ago I got a Goodreads account and I told myself every book you finish you must write something about it.
Hmm.
And I've been keeping it up for 3 years. It gets longer. The entries get longer and longer and longer and longer to the point where, like, I have a lot of anxiety now whenever I finish the book because now I have to write about it and I'm going to have to say too much about it. I don't know. I did some things for NYPL blog. I had, like, a flirtation with Latin poetry and I wrote a couple of entries about Latin poetry. And then I did a couple of entries about Lower East Side history.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a writer.
Hmm. I was just trying to think, like, if the scroll wasn't, like, drawn for Andrew, like, what is Andrew's medium? You know what I mean? Right. Is it writing? I actually feel like narration. I think actually the microphone is good for you.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you're a good talker. You're a good talker. We knew that. But there's some, I don't know, there's something about the reason I thought of the scroll because it wasn't, if you really do move along it from one end to the other, you don't know, you know, in one or two point perspective, you kind of have everything in front of you. If you move along from one direction to the other, and also you don't expect how a perspective is going to change, you don't know what's going to be revealed to you.
Mm.
And so it's almost like this drawing or this medium is made to to move or unfold or vibrate without actually without actually doing that. Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. And I know exactly where this is ought to be.
Yeah.
There's all those. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a beautiful room.
There's a few rooms. Of, yeah. No. I mean, that was. I regret actually when I moved to New York not spending more time, or not making a thing about going to the New York Public Libraries that were on offer there. I spent a lot of time at the Met.
Oh yeah.
Hours and hours.
Same.
And lots of other things.
It never ends. Mets.
Yeah.
You just keep coming back, and by the time you thought you've done it all, they've switched out the traveling exhibit, and you're like, oh, well, here we go.
I don't know. There's something I've never been. There's still something, I guess, a little bit, this is going to sound ridiculous, but it's a little intimidating about the library for me.
What is this? I'm curious.
Just never, I guess, being a very studious person, and I associate that a little bit with it. Which is absurd. The libraries are there for everybody and to use however they want.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess I don't know, maybe I'm too private or something. I don't like to that people know what I'm reading. I
Oh, sure.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Well,
I mean, you've helped me get over a lot of that.
Lovely.
Although I probably won't be let into Seward Park or Chatham Square anymore after all of my advertising.
And you are always welcome.
I'm the reason that there's a throng of kids running down the stairs every Wednesday and whatever other workshop.
I think we ought to take that as a good thing.
I hope
not
I
a bad
hope so.
Thing. Yeah. I don't know. All I can say about that is it's. I think the availability. Whether someone is using it all the time or not. And, you know, let's face it, I think one of the tragedies of our age is the degree to which we always feel like we have to be busy and working all the time. And the library is just one of those simply leisurable, like, it is a place of pure leisure just as much as it is a studious place. But the library being there, being available, mm-hmm. being a place open to everyone that anyone can just walk in and leave on their own volition, as long as they're not incredibly rude to other people,
mm-hmm.
is there's nothing else like it, literally.
Yeah.
I mean, I was meeting with these people for a while who were talking about the idea of public. It was called Future of Public.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about the idea of public and how the idea of public has changed through generations, you know. One of the things they brought up about libraries in particular is, can you imagine someone in Congress trying to build libraries? Or someone says, I've got an idea and we're going to build a network of public buildings that anyone can walk in and out of, regardless of whether they have a membership card.
Yeah.
And they can use the space, and they can borrow, and we just simply trust them. And even if they don't return on time, they can still come in. And I mean, it would be crazy. It wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I think what's missing today is a faith in, and it's sort of an unfashionable term, but a faith in the improvement of people, that if you give people nice things, they'll do nice things. I don't think anybody trusts that any longer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's two, I think there are two schools of thought on this that are embodied in Confucianism. There's Mencius, who I haven't read too much of, and there's Xunzi, who has a reputation of being like a very cranky person who thinks human nature is evil. But I actually sort of turned on his head, because Mencius, and I'm apologies if I'm just completely oversimplifying things, but for the sake of argument, Mencius believes in the goodness of people, and that, you know, people, when they lose touch of their, I don't know, inner child or something, are corrupted, and is civilization, you know, through civilization corrupts and so on and so on. And Xunzi, who again has this reputation for being a crank, mm-hmm. thinks that this is completely wrong. And I think the temptation in our society today is to say that, oh, of course Mencius is right, because, you know, we've seen so many trespasses of civilization and so on and so on. And, like, you know, we do sort of have this cult of worship around youth and childhood and so on, and the innocence of the child. But I think actually in this case, I'm on Shunza's side, because in turn, Shunza believes in the improvement of people, that it's not so much that people are evil, but it's that people need to learn to become harmonized with one another, and that it's unfortunately not something that's obvious to people. It's not something that it's education, basically. And I think we've lost a sort of value on an educational premise that perhaps. And I just finished reading Plato's Gorgias, and Plato is often, I think, the Western counterpart to Shunza in the East, mm-hmm. which, again, his emphasis is always on education and the improvement of people, and education is a channel for that. But it is the ability to say to yourself, I know what pleasure is, I know what the good is, and I know that they're different, and that my own immediate pleasure is possibly not what's good for the world, and... That's a good place to start, I think. And again, I think you see that in Shunza, and I think mm-hmm. you see that in Plato. And I think, you know, again, there's all this pressure for libraries to be proving themselves and proving their worth and proving mm-hmm. this and that and the other thing. And I think in the long run, it's just good that we're there, mm-hmm. that they're there and they're available, and that anyone at any point in their life could have done anything. You know, they could have been someone who has a passive drug addiction. They could be someone who's formerly incarcerated. They could be someone at any point in their life. They can come into a library and they could learn something, mm-hmm. or they could take something seriously and be treated with dignity. And I do not think that there's many places like that left. Yeah. So,
no, that's like, I think that's such an important thing, like to be treated with dignity too. Mm-hmm. Like, I think yeah. that's like, I mean, I don't know. Do you get like taught, like that's an important core value of being a person who works at the library?
I think it ought to be. I think it's talked about in a different way. Mm. I sort of have an old-fashioned way of thinking about it, where I think today there's a habit, and it's not a bad habit, it's a good habit. I think there's a habit of trying to isolate and identify types of personalities and the appropriate way to react to them. Mm. I think this is a good college try, right? It's good that mm-hmm. we're thinking about these things and realizing that people are different and so on and so on. But I think in the end, treating people, being polite goes a long way. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's something I'm, as much as I laud the attempt, there's something I'm suspicious of in trying to read a person and guess, how should I act with this person? Mm-hmm. You know, am I being too nice? Am I being too forward? Am I being too close? Am I too distant? Ah, I'm driving myself crazy, blah, blah, blah. Because the truth is, you don't know them, you know, and there's a number of assumptions you could come to. Politeness, manners, they go an incredibly long way. And I think that's what you need at the library. You don't measure a society. This is what I always say, and it relates directly to your question, is, to me, the health of a society is not measured by the way we treat our friends and the people we know or the people we assume we know. It's measured by the way we treat people we don't know, or complete and total strangers. And I'm sorry, but there's no way around it. Manners is everything, has everything to do with this. That the way you treat people is a reflection on... Well, I've just repeated myself, but you know what I'm saying.
We get it. It seems so serendipitous that you ended up at the library. It just doesn't, you know, this is something that I've understood about you, what you just explained very quickly. You can understand that because of the fact that you just explained that, but you can also understand that about you by walking in the library and saying hello to you. That's something that you carry around with you.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I mean it. And it would, you know, as much as I mean, you made me want to go to the library and not that, you know, that is a, you know, certain addition, but, I, you know, that's why I'm so intrigued that you, well, first of all, that you say, I don't know why I deserve these things. I think you are, and you know, giving a lot to an institution that is in turn also giving a lot to a community, and the two, you know, you are part of each other's internal system. You know, what the library's blood is running through you and back.
Well, I'm happy to do it.
It's nice to hear that instinctual decisions, which I think you make instinctual decisions over, you know, over analytical, you know, thoughts.
I think the world and does things to me.
And you kind of have been led in this direction, which seems to be such an incredible fit. Maybe there's another side to you that actually understands the world so much in so much more radiant detail.
Do we need to give Andrew the Myers-Briggs personality test?
Well, I was thinking about some of those questions.
No.
Well, that's and what you I were just saying. Yeah. Intuiting over sensing.
Right.
Well, actually, it was funny you say that. There's in that memoir by David Auerbach, there's a chapter on the Myers-Briggs.
Oh.
We have to be careful about the Myers-Briggs.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the danger is, of course, not... it's like the idea behind artificial intelligence, right? The danger isn't that computers will finally think like humans. The danger is that we think like computers, or like, you know, that we sort of act as these prescribed roles. Blah, blah, blah. You know, this is sort of the dream of the, you know, this keeps coming up, cybernetic period that just won't die. Is that the human mind and computers are exactly the same, and you can program them and you know, if anything, what we learned from the crazy experiments that the United States government poured the billions of dollars that were poured into trying to pinpoint the human mind as if it were a circuit board, we learned that that's not true. That the human mind is incredibly complex, and again, like. And it sort of goes back to what I was saying about decency, and like I think there's an attempt to sort of lay personality types bare and attempt to understand how we should react to them based on like these analyses, which again they come in handy to a point, but I think the main lesson of psychology is that we don't know ourselves, and that's probably the more scary thing. It's not that there's a type of personality we don't know about that's being ignored, it's that at any given time, I don't know who I am, and that there's a part of me that this is called thought to me, that there's what thought is. This is sort of the Hegelian idea. What thought is, according to Hegel, what art is, according to Hegel, or a thinker like Alenka Zupančič, what sexuality is, what civilization is. It's an attempt to paper over the essential dissatisfaction between a subject, a person, and their world. And this is what thinking is. It's this attempt to bridge that gap between a life world we're born into and this extreme isolation that the person feels when the language they speak is not their own, but that it's all that they have to make sense of the world. So I think I have a mistrust of an analytic which would try to, again, lay personality types bare, and so on. I think the contradiction is always there, and the most profound philosophical questions begin with someone who's willing to say, you know what, I don't know who I am. You know, I've lived this life for so long, and I could change due to circumstances at any minute, and that's terrifying, but it's an important thing to be in touch with.
All the pieces of you are falling into place. Like, all of this makes so much sense. Like, if you don't know who you are, then why plan for the future? Because you don't know who you're going to be 3 seconds from now.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is all falling into place.
Yeah.
I really like this.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's important to be strong in what you believe in, but you're right. It is a bit of a, you know, it's good to be prepared for these changes and all that.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I mean, I think
preparation's overemphasizing.
What did we, because we have the same personality according to
Myers-Briggs.
Is it a color or is it, what is it called?
Oh, it's the four letters. We're ENFJs.
Okay.
I forgot. We're feelers.
Feeling and judging. That sounds
feeling
right.
And judging.
Yeah. So, something like that. The title for the result is that we're both teachers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
You were just saying how hard it would be to be a teacher because you have to say goodbye to the kids every year.
Oh. Well, that's because we're also incredibly empathetic. Like, we have, like, everything in our lives are kind of controlled by feelings and emotions. Yeah. So, this totally makes sense.
We both are intuitive thinkers, I guess. Mm-hmm.
A little bit.
Yeah.
All right.
And I feel... But I like how what you just said relates... I mean, I basically want to say more than ever, kids, throw away your phones. I mean, you don't have to pick up a book. You don't, have to, but at least, I mean, 2001 A Space Odyssey proved it to you. Yeah. Computers are not going to be the thing that's...
I couldn't agree more. Not that that's a... I mean, it's that... I'm a last generation possibly that did not have a computer in their house till I was like 16. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I'm really grateful for that. Yeah. You know, like all engagement with play is through someone else's network. Like it's just crazy. I don't know. You're at such a remove from what you're engaging with. It's tricky. I don't know.
Yeah. Are you saying that you kind of like it's a prescribed interface? Like it's not like the kind of like, you know, when we were kids, we would just take paper and like make whatever we would make, paper clothes for dolls. What are those called? Paper dolls or whatever. Or we would like make origami things. Like, a piece of paper could be like anything. And all it was a piece of paper. And then we had to decide what we were going to do with it. You know, as opposed to like an app, which is like you can pick from three things. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Exactly. And when you do that, there's a million and one ways to make a mistake. And you have to sort through them. When you play a video game, you can make mistakes, but there's only a few ways you can make a mistake. Yeah. And you just have to sort of sift through them. And I mean, the variables aren't so great, you know. And I think that ought to be challenging to grow up, that environment to grow up in. I mean, I for one don't really know how that's going to manifest in adulthood, but I don't know. Could it be good in a way? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I know that. I mean, my mother, she wherever we would go, we traveled a lot, and was very fortunate to be taken by them every 3 years on a 3-week trip somewhere that we hadn't discovered anywhere in the world. And she would have with her almost an entire suitcase of books and paper and crayons and all sorts of, endless amount of things for us to be busy with. She always, and we had 1 to 2 hours a day where we had to keep ourselves occupied.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where it would be my parents' time, we would, we could do whatever we wanted. We could use those things, but we were to keep ourselves. And my brother and sister were quite good at that. I was never good at playing by myself. If I was all those moments where I was told to go and hang out in my room, I had a doll that I could have played with. I could have drawn. I could have picked up a book and read. I didn't want to do those things. I was happiest when I was sitting at the adult dinner table and talking to people, and I could have other people around me somehow. I didn't want to be alone. And also I didn't have television growing up, let alone computer. Well, we had them, but we weren't allowed to watch them. And only when I was 16, 17 was I allowed to go on the computer, or maybe a little younger than that. But the computer was, it entertained all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Our three different siblings, three different personalities, three different, very different reactions of playing by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You put a computer in front of any of us, there's no difference between us anymore.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. And I think that is a perfect illustration of what I'm talking about.
And it's also scary because that's, for me, where you get a kind of identity crisis also later on when you don't have anything in the world to be intuitive to.
Right, right. No, you're definitely onto something there. I think that is so true. That is so true. Because, It's, yeah. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. That is so true. It flattens personality.
Yeah.
It flattens personality. And again, I think personality then becomes like sort of another consumer choice, I guess. Like, you know, something you can buy on Amazon or something like that.
I was being entertained.
Yeah, something like that.
Andrew, we have to start wrapping up.
Okay.
I wish we could go on talking for
as do I
forever.
But we know where to find
you. We know where to find you.
Yeah. 192 East Broadway, folks. If you don't have a library card yet, get one now because we're doing a sign-up drive. So.
Oh.
Maybe we should go get library cards.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Do you have to have a local postcode?
Yeah, let me tell you. If you have
code? That's what it's called, a postcode.
You could be in Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, doesn't matter.
Okay, awesome.
You could even be in New York State. There's even a card for that. You could be a visitor. There's a 3 months card. To get a regular library card, what you need is a New York State ID or a city ID. Mm-hmm. That's all you need. If you don't have that, take your passport or your old state ID or whatever photo ID you have with your date of birth and so on, and bring that in concert with a letter with your address on it. If you don't have a letter, mail yourself a postcard. That'll do. Bring in those two things if you don't have your New York State ID, and you will get a library card. It takes about 2 minutes, and you walk out the door with a card right there. There is no mailing your card for the New York Public Library. You get it right then and there. You can leave that day with books.
Another thing that is unique to New York Public Library, you leave with
the card.
There's a little bit of paperwork involved, but it's minimal, and you leave with a card, which is a very important thing. One thing I forgot to mention in the beginning of the interview is that, unfortunately, Sean Ferguson, the manager of Chatham Square branch of New York Public Library, couldn't join us today.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to him some other time, because I'm sure he has a whole other breadth of stories.
He is such an interesting guy. Beyond libraries, he works on so much, and he's a very busy man.
Good to hear. Well, thank you, Andrew.
My pleasure.
Thank you for holding your drawing workshops here, for trusting us enough to to teach in this environment, and for making these beautiful drawings too, which we're going to treasure. Well, also you're welcome to take them too. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And keep on keeping on.
Keep
on. Yeah, someone said that.
You can count on that in some form or another. Thanks to everybody who was listening.
Let's make an actual approachable and inclusive and warm version of the etiquette book together. So that and we can call it the library.
Yes, indeed. I would love
public
that.
Or something.
Public. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. The spirit of public.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
My pleasure.
Thank you.